12 years ago, Richard White began writing an account of how the Transcontinental Railroad was built and its impact on the American West. The railroads, he says, were corporate behemoths whose financial manipulations blazed the path, followed by almost every industry since. And during the time that Professor White was working on the book, he witnessed the growth of the Internet, the rise of the dot-coms, the collapse of Enron, most recently the financial crisis. It became apparent to him that there were many parallels between how the railroad corporations conducted their business, including their roles in politics, and the events of the late 20th and early 21st centuries. His book, Railroaded, The Transcontinentals and the Making of Modern America, is published by Norton. I'm very pleased that it brings Richard White, the Margaret Byrne Professor of American History at Stanford University, to our show today. Welcome.
Well, I'm very glad to be here, Leonard.
In your introduction, you write that all of the possibilities that arose with railroads seemed magnified in the Transcontinentals, which came to epitomize progress, nationalism, and civilization itself, not just in the United States, but in Canada and Mexico as well. That's quite a lot of stuff hanging on the success of these Transcontinentals.
Yeah, it was a lot hanging on it, and that's why I think historians have only looked to the point where they were finished and tended to ignore much of what happened after that. Because the completion of the roads was a great national triumph. It was a cause for celebration in the United States. Same thing happened when the Canadian Pacific was completed. It was a cause of national triumph. But if you look at these things closer, what you begin to realize is they're more important for their failures than their successes.
Well, did the Transcontinentals actually span the continent?
No, they didn't. I mean, the American Transcontinentals start from the Missouri River. The Union Pacific starts from Omaha, connects with the Central Pacific, which goes to San Francisco. They're transcontinentals only because they then link up with other lines that connect to the East Coast. And one of their problems is they are built into an area where there would be very little traffic for most of the rest of the 19th century.
But isn't your area of expertise the history of the West? How rapidly did its population grow once the transcontinentals were built?
Well, the population doesn't grow as fast as they want it to do, and here you have to be careful. Part of the West will grow very, very quickly. That's the West that goes up to about the 98th meridian, the middle of Nebraska these days. That's the most fertile farmland in the world, and that would have settled whether you built transcontinentals or not. The West Coast, California, was already settling, and its growth would disappoint Californians. Californians expected a lot from the railroads, which they really wouldn't receive until the 20th century, and it's in between that I'm talking about, between the 98th meridian and the mountains and the west. This does settle because they promote settlement, but what you have to look at is that many of the people who came in immediately flowed out. Much of the settlement was disastrous.
And those farmers and livestock breeders who you talk about weren't always very happy either.
No, the railroads become very unpopular very quickly. They're denounced as a monopoly. And in the 19th century, what Americans mean by monopoly is not that a single railroad controls all the traffic, but rather that they are something which everybody has to use once they are created. And there is a great deal of doubt whether these kinds of things should be left in private control, particularly when they would not have been built without government assistance.
They also had control over the rates that they charged, which not everybody was happy about.
Well, one of the things about railroad rates is historians for a long time have pointed out that railroad rates fell constantly in the 19th century. So they say, well, what are these people so angry at? Well, what they're angry at is that the rates are utterly unpredictable and they're also secret. By manipulating the rates, railroads can quite literally take places which seem to be nearer to another place and move them farther away. They can give advantages to some shippers and take them away from other shippers. So for Americans in the 19th century, what happens, this is why they're a monopoly, what happens is that something which should depend on how hard you work and the advantages that you've managed to accrue to yourself really depends on somebody who is changing numbers on a sheet of paper deciding your access to markets. And to them, this seems just fundamentally wrong. This is one of the major reasons why people are so angry at the railroads.
You make the case that the modern corporation was born with the transcontinental railroads. What are some characteristics of the modern corporation that came out of them?
Well, what the modern railroads have to do is they have to operate over a large amount of space And so that they need a management structure which, in fact, can span that space and report back to a central office. What you need for a modern railroad corporation is a bureaucracy. You also need to have some command over technology. These trains can't be running into each other. So what you find is that you need a communication system that has to work for them. Because they are so large and span such a large area, you have a workforce which is larger than the number of people employed by many states, and indeed the railroads employ far more people than work for the U.S. government. What you begin to get is a source of private power which really begins to rival public power. Also, the railroads, at least in the West, depend so heavily on the federal government that they find they have to influence federal policy to survive.
So they get involved with politics.
They get involved with politics. I argue here that it's the Western railroads that really invent the modern law. And they do so not so much by bribing people, though they're perfectly willing to bribe people, but rather by creating what I call friends. These are people who have a reciprocal relationship with the railroad. They're people who will work for the railroad after they leave office. They're lawyers who will argue cases for the railroad. There are people who will get private gifts from the railroad and give public favors. That all of these people are so entwined with the railroads that sometimes it's hard to tell where a U.S. senator's duty to the United States leaves off and his obligations to a railroad corporation begin.
Yesterday we talked about Clarence Darrow, who is often seen as the lawyer for the disenfranchised, but he worked for the railroads at one point.
It's very hard for any prominent lawyer in the 19th century not to work for the railroads. Abraham Lincoln worked for the railroads at one point. What the railroads would do is to buy up virtually all the best legal talent along their lines because they are sued a lot. They have a lot of legal obligations, and so they don't have a complete monopoly on legal talent, but it's very hard to find any prominent lawyer in the 19th century who did not do work for the railroads.
Now, you talked about other industries that were affected, and this is around the time that major corporations were rising, like Standard Oil, Western Union, Carnegie Steel. Did they all become connected with the railroads?
They're all intertwined with the railroads, the reasons vary. Carnegie Steel is the steel industry is selling pretty much 80%, I think, of its product to railroads in the 19th century. The railroads are
that's more than building skyscrapers at the end of the 19th century.
Skyscrapers come late. Remember, skyscrapers come in the 1890s. Before that, most of the steel goes into railroad track and it goes into bridges. Later on, it's going to begin to go into skyscrapers in Chicago and then later in New York. But initially, the market is largely a railroad market. Before pipelines come about, Standard Oil has to ship by railroads. And you have a very interesting, very corrupt relationship between Standard Oil and the railroads. Rockefeller is one of the few industrialists who proves more powerful than the railroads in this case. But Rockefeller cannot move his oil, cannot get it to refineries without tank cars and tank car fleets. Western Union is, for much of the 19th century, Jay Gould's corporation. And over a lot of the country, the Western Union follows the railroad tracks. It's intimately related to the railroads.
In fact, in the old movies, we see somebody go to the railroad station to send a telegram.
That's right, because that's one place where the railroads have to have telegraph connections. You cannot manage a modern train system without knowing where your trains are, without having these kinds of telegraphic connections.
My guest is Richard White. His book, Railroaded, The Transcontinentals and the Making of Modern America, published by Norton. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You mentioned the role of government. Did the federal government subsidize the building of these railroads?
Without federal subsidies, these railroads would not have been built. What the federal government does is, during the Civil War, they have a legitimate reason. There's a fear that California will break away from the Union. They feel they need a line that will connect California with the rest of the United States. This is the major argument they make for subsidizing the railroads. The problem is the railroad doesn't really start to get built until 1865 and the war is over. California is part of the Union. You really don't need it. But by then, the first bill is through and many others have followed. And what you get is subsidies, which in the case of the Union Pacific and Central Pacific are guaranteeing their bonds, which otherwise would not have been able to be sold. And after that, immense land grants. The North Northern Pacific, for example, gets an area that's roughly the equivalent of all of New England as a land grant to build from Minnesota to Washington Territory.
And those land grants, did they go over areas that were owned by other people, or were they all owned by the federal government?
No, the federal government is giving away other people's land. The federal government has not acquired title to much of this land from Indian nations, and therefore the building of the railroads is going to be a major cause of the Indian wars. The railroads take credit for conquering the Indians, but one thing I would argue is if you hadn't built the railroads, there wouldn't have been the need to conquer the Indians. The settlement is not going to go forward without the railroads. What we tend to forget is that, especially west of the 98th Meridian, the railroads are responsible for one of the great land promotions in American history. It's not as if people are waiting to go out there to settle. They're lured out there by railroad advertisements, by railroad subsidies, by the railroad's necessity to try to get somebody producing something to put on these trains.
Despite all of this, was there ever any question about whether these were purely private corporations?
Yeah, in the 19th century, they want to nationalize them, because the argument that's made is these are corporations which have been built supposedly for a public purpose. They've been built with large public subsidies. Once they are built, they are things that the public depends upon. And the 19th century argument is we should treat them much like we treat other transportation infrastructure. You don't have private, we have some private roads, but most of the roads are in fact public. They are talking about treating them the same way we treat an interstate highway today. And there's this very strong move, which only dissipates in the early 20th century, to nationalize at least part of these roads, to have them run the same way the government runs the post office.
You write that the story of the rise of the transcontinental emphasizes finance capitalism, the use of credit and the financial markets as the central engine of corporate growth and expansion of the late 19th century North America.
Yes, and it's one of the things that's most reminiscent about the current financial crisis. I mean, here it's private borrowing that largely goes into mortgages that spur the crisis. In the 19th century, it's corporate borrowing. These railroads did not really have investors. They had people who loaned them money.
Mostly the federal government, you're saying.
In the first ones that the federal government would guarantee that they would be paid back. And as a matter of fact, the federal government also thought it would be paid back by the railroads. My own university, Stanford, nearly closed because when Leland Stanford died and endowed Stanford University, he had neglected to pay back the federal government the money that the Central Pacific had borrowed from it, and the federal government sued the Stanford estate to get the money back. A settlement was reached. But they were reluctant to pay this money back. But without the kind of federal guarantees beyond the first ones, people would not have invested. And these are bad investments. These railroads go bankrupt repeatedly. And as they go bankrupt, much as in the current financial crisis, they throw the United States into very deep, very serious depressions in which all kinds of other businesses then fail after them.
Michael Kazin, who wrote the review of your book in the New York Times, wonders whether you're not biting the hand that feeds you when you go after Leland Stanford, the man who endowed the university that employs you.
Well, I don't think Stanford employed me in order to praise its founders. Leland Stanford, in fact, is a very interesting historical figure who I think deserves a kind of critical look. And I guess I am biting the hand that feeds me, except the modern Stanford University is made up of a lot more than the original Stanford endowment. But that's what I do. I don't pretend to be particularly popular with the people who employ me all the time.
You mentioned the housing bubble, and I want to get to that in a moment. But I'm also wondering about this government-private corporation cooperation that we've been talking about. You're right. The question is not whether governments shape markets, it's how they shape markets. Are you surprised by how that doesn't play out these days in the discussion of the current financial crisis? How many people just want government to get totally out of everything?
Yeah, I am sort of shocked. I mean, it shows a deep ignorance, really, about the past of this country and how, in fact, markets have worked and the role in the government. You know, people can read my book and say, well, this is an argument why the government should not get involved. Look at all the corruption that followed. But my argument would be somewhat different. This is an argument about why, if this kind of government-business cooperation is inevitable, and I think in some ways it is, then you need very strong regulatory forces. You really have to watch what's going on.
And there was no regulation in the 19th century because it was all pretty much a laissez-faire mentality.
Well, they're trying to bring in regulation. I mean, one of the things that strikes me about the political conversation in the 19th century is that it's so much more robust and in many ways so much more intelligent in the 20th century. They start this system without really knowing what they've gotten involved in. But once American citizens recognize what they've gotten involved in, they come out very strongly for business regulation. They see that, in fact, there is no going back to a simpler system where there are not corporations and where there's not a powerful government. And if this is the case, then you have to do something about it. It'll lead eventually to the progressive era in the early 20th century. So I think in the 19th century, what starts out as a sort of lip service to laissez-faire, even though it's not really laissez-faire, they quickly come around to recognize the need for regulation and also recognize how difficult it is to get honest and effective regulation, and they work at it very, very hard.
And one of the leaders of that move was Theodore Roosevelt, who was a Republican.
Yeah, one of the things that happens when you look at anti-monopoly, we tend to think, well, you know, the radicals and reformers in the 19th century are populists. But the people I call anti-monopolists are present in all the parties. They're present in the Democrats, they're present in the Republicans, they're present in third parties like the populists. This is a widespread and important reform movement that has been largely, I think, underrated and ignored by many historians.
My guest is Richard White, who is the Margaret Byrne Professor of American History at Stanford University. His book, Railroaded, The Transcontinentals and the Making of Modern America, is published by Norton, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Richard White, who is the Margaret Byrne Professor of American History at Stanford University. His new book, Railroaded, The Transcontinentals and the Making of Modern America, is published by Norton. And we mentioned the housing market earlier and also the fact that the railroads went bust. Are there a lot of parallels in that regard?
Yeah, I think there are. I mean, what you have in both instances is a time in which you have large institutions which really are beginning to market securities which nobody really understands. The railroads were operating, marketing securities that now are fairly common, stocks, various kinds of bonds. They're not nearly as sophisticated as the kinds of securities that led up to the housing collapse. But in each case, they're utterly unregulated, and a series of claims are made for them that simply can't be substantiated. You begin to build up a house of cards, and once the first card is taken out, the whole thing begins to tumble. Now, what's scariest to me is we've gone through one financial crisis, and I have not seen a great deal of reform that's come out of it so far. The railroads collapsed in 1872, 1873. They collapsed again in the early 1880s, and then they collapsed again in the early 1890s, each time triggering either depressions or very, very deep recessions. And so one of the things that the railroads seem to indicate is that just because this happened once doesn't mean that they're going to correct it the second time, that these crises can follow one after another. That's the parallel that bothers me the most.
Well, there's a graph in your book that's particularly startling. It's a distribution of Union Pacific stockholders by cities in 1869, and the overwhelming majority is owned in New York and Boston. So that would suggest the railroads were funded in large part by the wealthy of the East, but were they hurt every time the railroads went bust?
The wealthy of the East didn't pay anything for those stocks. that's the interesting thing about 19th century stock. What the railroads do is they borrow money from bonds. And if you loan the railroads money, and if you're an insider in a corporation like the Crédit Mobilier, for the money that's loaned in, you get stock. So all of those investors that you see in that chart are people who invested most of them in the Crédit Mobilier, which is the insider company that built the Union Pacific at a huge profit. They got part of their money in bonds, part of their money in cash, part of their money in stock. So that the thing about the stockholders report of a 19th century railroad corporations is really one of the great fictional genres of the 19th century. The stockholders did not pay anything for the stock, and that becomes one of the sources of deep, deep corruption in these roads, and I'm talking about the original stockholders.
Whereas the Crédit Mobilier, a French corporation?
No, just a French name. They wanted it to sound good. They bought up the name. What the Crédit Mobilier does is evade a law. I won't go into all the details of how the government wrote the law, but it was easily evaded. So what they did is contracted with themselves. The board of the Union Pacific then contracted with themselves and another corporation called the Crédit Mobilier to build the Union Pacific Railroad. They built it at, you know, estimates run up to, twice the cost, maybe more, that it otherwise would have cost, and pocketed the difference. So they make a huge amount of money in building the road, and then once the road is built, they've paid themselves in bonds. They sell the bonds at a discount, but they're still making a huge amount of money from that, too. So this is insider capitalism. This is how people who control a corporation can actually wreck the corporation but make a great deal of money themselves.
Well, the French name reminds me that railroads are quite popular in France, in Italy, in Spain, in the Scandinavian countries, a lot more than in this country. Is that because they were built differently and don't have the scandals attached, or is it just because America became an automobile society?
No, it's partially both, but in the 19th century, other capitalist countries built railroads very, very differently. England, for example, Great Britain, they insisted that stockholders actually pay for their stock. The French government took a much greater role in making sure the railroads were laid out in ways that were more rational and didn't have this sort of redundancy and overbuilding that American railroads had. The Germans operate in a third system. So there were good ways to build railroads in the 19th century. We picked a way which could build them very fast, relatively cheaply, and we put off the consequences until later, but the consequences came.
But you pointed out earlier that one of the reasons for the government pushing for the development is the Civil War and the fear that the West might very well break away.
Right, and that is a rational reason in 1865. The problem is by 1865, those reasons no longer apply. And one of the things that surprised me, these are freight railroads, and as I looked at how you actually move goods across the country in the 19th century, it is cheaper and usually almost as fast to ship them down to Panama, put them on a railroad, then ship them into the eastern United States and put them on a railroad again than it is to ship them across the country.
Why is that?
Well, I mean, you have to know a lot about how railroads work. If you think about a 19th century railroad, for people my age, think about a Tinker Toy set, where you have the stick and then you have the little hub that you stick them into. A railroad car is not put on a train in San Francisco and sent all the way to New York. It is put on a train and sent to Sacramento. At Sacramento, the car will be detached from a train and wait for another train to be made up. It'll go, let's say, to Reno. And from there, it'll go on, let's say, to Ogden, and from there, so forth, across the country. Each time it stops, it might sit there for a day or 2 days. Sometimes it's put on a siding and sits there longer.
Well, why did they develop that system? It sounds counterproductive.
Well, it's the same way we run the Internet today. When you think about how the Internet works, you divide it up into little packets of information. And it's not counterproductive if, in fact, you don't have a lot of traffic. If there's not enough traffic to send a car all the way to Chicago every day from San Francisco, then you've got to wait until you have enough cars to make it economical to put a train together. And that's how this works. The lower the amount of traffic, the longer it takes to put a train together, the longer it takes takes to put a train together, the slower the traffic moves. It's going to take them much of the century to get a system of moving cars that really begins to work. And so once you know something about the details of how the system works, it makes it clear why when you put it on a ship, the ship's not going to stop till it gets to another place. And that makes up for the slower speed, makes up a lot for the delays on railroads.
The real history of the rise of these railroads, you write, cuts against the traditional narrative that the rise of the West is about promise, progress, and success, that the West is the homeland of America's future. What is the reality of the situation?
The reality is like any human life. It's much more mixed. There are successful people in the West, but what we tend to do is gloss over a lot of the failures, especially if you look at this region west of the 100th Meridian. People still get angry about it today, but the fact is that much of that area peaked in population in 1920, and it's been leaking people ever since. The large amounts of the West should not have been settled when they did and in the way they did. And the price that's paid is not something that's paid for immediately. It goes on for over a century. A lot of the environmental harm in the region, a lot of the social harm, a lot of the decline, a lot of this has to do with the way we settled it, and we settled it with the railroads. There's a cost to mistakes. I mean, the United States tends to gloss over its mistakes, and that sometimes is not the best thing to do. It's best to recognize that these kinds of decisions have real consequences.
Is the crisis in California today a matter of paying the price for all of these things?
No, I don't think the modern California crisis is related to the railroads per se. I mean, it's helped me sell books if I could say it all traces back to the railroads, but I'm not going to make that claim. I think the crisis in California today.
Go ahead.
The crisis in California today largely comes down to an unwillingness, I think, of Californians to pay the kind of infrastructure that's done them so much good.
Another myth you address in your book cuts against the evolution of corporations and economic development in the United States.
Yeah, I went into this book thinking that corporations would emerge as the first sort of rational, structured bureaucracy. And what I found is that they were incredibly poorly run and that they were a refuge for a kind of manliness that you usually associate with 19th century sports, boxing or football, that these are people who are concerned about their pride, their manhood, and will do incredible things, even though it's going to cost the corporations hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars. It's one of the things that drives the people running them crazy. These are not the kind of bureaucratic, rational corporations that I expected to find.
What's your take on Mitt Romney's claim that corporations are people?
Mitt Romney belongs in the court in California in the 1870s. I mean, my response to Mitt Romney would be the outrage that in the Santa Clara case, the governor of California at the time, when he was told that, in fact, corporations were persons, he said, and I tend to agree with him, that the court did not understand the distinction between a corporate person and a citizen of the United States, that a citizen of the United States is someone who created the government. A corporate person is somebody created by the government, and you cannot equate something created by the government with the people who, in fact, have created the government itself. It's a kind of fundamental misunderstanding that Mitt Romney is seeking to perpetuate today. I mean, the claim is absolute nonsense.
Richard White has written a book called Railroaded, The Transcontinentals and the Making of Modern America. It is published by Norton. The rise of the railroads is a brutal history. Can you talk about all the different players, the workers, those who needed to use the railroads to move their produce and livestock, those who lost their land to the railroads? We've kind of touched on it, but there's a lot of fascinating detail in these stories.
Yeah, one of the things we tend to forget is how dangerous working life was in the 19th century. And railroads and mines were probably the two most dangerous occupations that anybody could have. These railroads, the way you break the railroad car, especially a freight car, into the 1880s, 1890s, was you guys standing on top of them with those wheels you see on the top of an old railroad freight car. Those are handbrakes, and they have to be tightened, and you don't have one guy per wheel. He has to move from car to car. And you can imagine yourself on one of these cars on a dark night. It can be snowing. You're coming down a mountainside, and what is slowing and controlling the train is somebody scrambling back and forth across these cars. The cars go through snow sheds, which if you don't duck in time, kill you when you hit them. And that's the way you stop a train. It's costs many brakemen their lives, but it's not the most dangerous thing that happens on a train. The most dangerous thing is the most basic thing about the train. It's attaching the cars. To attach the cars, you have to jump in between them and drive a pin into the lock to lock the couplers together. This causes you your fingers if you're lucky, but if you're a little too slow, very often it knocks you down, the train runs over you. So there's all kinds of graphic accounts. Even conservative senators like Henry Cabot Lodge finally are outraged by the 1890s that the railroads have not gone to automatic braking systems for freight cars. And he says every year the number of people killed and injured in the railroads are equivalent to the loss in the Civil War Battle of Shiloh. This is simply this day-in, day-out kind of brutality for workers, which is one of the major things fueling unions and brotherhoods at the time. So the running of the trains, which people don't see, brings a huge cost. And every time these workers are hurt, of course, that's a family that is losing its breadwinner. So the other thing about that we tend to forget about is that all that land that goes to the railroad comes from Indian peoples. And it's not that eventually Indian peoples aren't going to have to deal with the railroads and there isn't going to be a loss of land, but my argument is without the railroads, if they had been built when they were needed at the end of the century, much of the West would look a lot more like the Navajo Reservation with the land base still intact than like Pine Ridge or other reservations, which split up and much of the land has been lost. There's just all kinds of costs when you begin to look into it, which are never really measured and counted against the good that the railroads do.
Well, what about the building of the railroads? Was that dangerous? Largely built, at least from the western side, by imported Asian labor.
Yeah, railroad work, track laying work, is some of the most brutal work in the West. And the reason you have to bring in so many Chinese to do it is that other workers will not take much of that work. It's the same thing in later on building the other railroads. A lot of it will be built by Eastern European workers because native-born workers are not going to want to do this work. The work is arduous. It's dangerous. It's not as dangerous as being a trainman, but it's dangerous enough, and it's low-paying. And it's always been one of the sort of entree positions into American life. It's Chinese come, Mexicans come. You can usually gauge how bad work is by the immigrant groups that come in to take it. And when you have to recruit immigrants to take this low-paying, dangerous work, you get an idea of the kind of work that it was.
And then the Chinese were discriminated against once the railroads were built.
Once the railroads are built, it's one of the interesting things about the Chinese Exclusion Act is that it really is over. It comes just as they no longer need that mass of Chinese labor, either in Canada or the United States. And when the other railroads are built, the Great Northern, they'll use Japanese labor on it. They'll replace the Chinese with Japanese. So, yeah, I mean, this is work which is precisely because it's the most dangerous work will go to those workers who are regarded as the most expendable.
Despite the complicated and sometimes nasty history of the building of these railroads, isn't there still quite a bit of romance tied to the whole idea of the transcontinental railroad? And I add on, despite the fact that they're barely used these days.
Yeah, there is. I mean, I think there's actually be a new TV series that's coming out about the building of the transcontinentals. And in fact, there are numerous bestsellers, and you probably will see several more in the next 10 years, all of them about the building of it, because it is a romantic achievement. I mean, what you have is the most modern technology being thrown into what Americans regard as the wildest place on the continent. And this juxtaposition of modern technology and wilderness is something that proves irresistible to Americans, and with good reason. It is a romantic story, and I don't particularly even want to deflate the romance that goes with it. I just want to point out the consequences of once you do these things, well what happens next? And this is a book about what happens next.
The romance kind of continues into the hoboing era, but No more. Nobody's hopping freights anymore, or at least as far as I can tell. Richard White is the winner of a MacArthur Award and the Parkman Prize and the Margaret Byrne Professor of American History at Stanford University. And his book, Railroaded, the Transcontinentals and the Makings of Modern America, is published by Norton. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Leonard. I've enjoyed it. Bye.